This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Missouri has the nation's third highest rate of domestic violence. That breaks down to about 4 in 10 women and 3 in 10 men who experience some form of intimate partner physical violence, sexual violence, or stalking. Those figures have been on an upward trend. But that's not the whole picture, because so many cases don't get reported at all. Behind those numbers are real people who want to escape such violence and need various kinds of help to do so. And the new nonprofit, St. Louis Survivors Legal Support, aims to provide what's necessary to build a new life of peace and safety. Here to talk with us about what prompted the creation of that organization, we have Mike Burton, founder of St. Louis Survivors Legal Support and retired St. Louis County Circuit Judge. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Elaine.
And we also have Monique Green, board president of St. Louis Survivors Legal Support and pastor at Living the Word Church in Collinsville, Illinois. Welcome to you as well.
Good afternoon, Elaine.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Now, Mike, before we get to the founding of St. Louis Survivors Legal Support, can you talk about domestic violence rates in Missouri and the STL region, especially some of the more recent figures?
The rates that you've mentioned, Elaine, as far as Missouri is concerned, really are very similar here in the St. Louis area. At this time, what we have seen as far as statistics are concerned, both nationally and locally, are that as bad as they are in the way that you've just described, they're even worse for African-American women and for those that are non-binary. Mm-hmm. The numbers are horrible.
Yeah.
What we see as far as specific statistics here in the area, I'll go by the number of orders of protection that are filed in the city and the county. Right now in the city, annually about 3,000 are filed. In St. Louis County, it's about double that, about 6,000. But the problem is that those numbers hardly reflect the amount of abuse. We mm-hmm. know that according to national statistics and local statistics, that no more than 10% report the abuse. And we know that that number is even incredibly lower for those that come forward to file.
Mm-hmm. And in so far as what you have seen as a judge, we noted that you are retired, but during that time that you served as a judge in court, what kind of perspective did that give you about what victims face, especially over the course of a case?
Well, I saw thousands of cases involving domestic violence, and the fear is real. What I've seen as far as orders of protection are concerned is that, to me, one of the most staggering figures was the fact that very few people come forward to the hearing to express their request for protection.
Mm-hmm.
I probably need to explain the order of protection
yes,
process first.
Yeah.
What has to happen is a victim needs to come forward and file a petition for an order of protection. And then once they do that, it's presented to a judge that's on duty at that time to take any of those requests. And then the judge determines whether or not that petition itself warrants getting a temporary order of protection.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, the judge then will set the matter for a hearing. Usually it's about 2 to 3 weeks later.
Okay.
And at that time, the individual needs to come forward to present their evidence.
Mm-hmm.
What I saw as a judge was an alarming number of people did not come forward. I would read these files while I was calling the docket, mm-hmm. and I would notice that probably the most serious allegations involved folks that did not appear. And I had no choice, and no judge has that option mm-hmm. but to dismiss a case like that. And it really made me pause and wonder what the situation was.
Right.
After I retired, I started getting the statistics, and the statistics proved to be horrendous. And that is that almost 80% of petitions for orders of protection are dismissed. Now, sometimes they're dismissed for very understandable reasons. Sometimes that's part of the agreement ultimately between the parties if they're dissolving their marriage or they're trying to address custody. Sometimes folks have to have their case dismissed because we can't get service, because we don't know the address of the respondent or where the respondent is located. Oftentimes they hide out from the sheriffs that are there to serve the petition.
Mm-hmm.
But what we know from experts and the statistics bear it out, that what happens is the individual respondent gets served with that petition and does whatever he can to make sure that that petitioner does not appear, whether it's false promises or threats or violence. Those individuals do not appear in court.
Yeah.
And that's a big concern.
And you say he because the overwhelming majority of those who are filing petitions are women?
That's correct. And the overwhelming majority, something along the lines of 85% of the abusers are male.
Mm-hmm. As a judge, when you've had to dismiss an order, what does that feel like?
There's many an occasion where you feel horrible. You see the distress on the victim's face when you basically say to them, there's nothing more we can do. You can always come back to court to get that help. Hopefully next time around, you'll have more information.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got incredibly compassionate judges that are on our bench, and they will certainly give that petitioner the opportunity to make several efforts to get that person served.
Mm.
But after a few months, they just have no choice. And it's a horrible feeling to watch someone that you know is suffering.
Monique, for your part, I mean, how much of what Mike has shared, what he's described, reflects why you've become involved with the St. Louis Survivors Legal Support?
Well, first I'd like to say how Mike and I met, because I think that's a very important part of our story.
Mm-hmm.
My husband and I were actually serving in the community of East St. Louis during the get back to school time frame, and we were delivering backpacks to an organization that he and his wife, Sheila, who's also an attorney, started, Join Hands.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, after a few minutes of conversation, we recognized that we actually went to the same college, mm-hmm. lived in the same dorm at Notre Dame, and the four of us had acquaintances in common.
Mm-hmm.
Then Mike shared with us what had been placed on his heart to start this organization, and he simply asked me to join, not even knowing that I am a survivor of domestic violence.
Yeah.
So given the opportunity to give back to something that I suffered through was really important, and that is how I got involved
mm-hmm.
in SLSLS.
Right. Now, as I understand, and you've mentioned that you yourself are a survivor, can you share a little bit about what you experienced navigating those years of domestic abuse?
Yes, I'll try my best to do so.
Thank you.
I was in my early 30s when I first experienced abuse, albeit it was probably a few years later before I began to recognize it as abuse. Many people feel that victims of abuse should immediately recognize what they're going through. But when you're married or you have a relationship with someone that you feel you love and you're married and you have children, it becomes much more complex than just saying, oh, this person is abusing me. So about 2007, I started to seek additional help because I did recognize the abuse. I experienced emotional, physical, and financial abuse over about a 15-year period. And it only ceased when I physically separated myself from the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Abuse typically starts as something verbal, and then it progresses. And that's why a big myth about abuse is you can just recognize it immediately. And during that time frame, when I sought my first attorney, The attorney was more concerned about my financial statement at that time than the fact that I was explaining I was in an abusive situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I will give that attorney benefit of the doubt and say perhaps that attorney did not understand abuse. So finally, I was able to get that attorney to move forward after a year of saying this is an abusive situation. Through the court system, I did get an order of protection, but the attorney did not help me understand how to enforce that order of protection. When I would reach out to the attorney and say, there's a violation going on here, the response was, well, you need to do this on your own. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking, I'm paying you for this particular service. So during the course, I read books on marriage. I went to churches. I sought the counsel of ministers, and I did everything seeking help, except I did not go to my family because of shame and embarrassment and just feeling I'd made the wrong decision.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout the court process, during my divorce and trying to navigate this, my case involved two judges in St. Louis County, three family of court attorneys, three guardian ad litems, one attorney in civil court, one court, the Missouri Appeals Court, a judge in St. Clair County, and an attorney in St. Clair County. And my legal bills exceeded $300,000 to simply try and get out of an abuse situation. So having that advocate educated on mm-hmm. each point in the process is critical to the success of anyone moving through the system. And what I can say is whether you have money or not, abuse knows no economic status,
mm-hmm.
it knows no color, and it knows no gender.
Yeah. So Mike, as you hear Monique tell this story to us, it's obviously one that you have already heard. What about it is kind of most connected to the reason you started this organization, SLS? And how different is its approach when it comes to dealing with some of the very specific issues that Monique's story illuminates?
There's a lot to respond to there, Elaine, but I'll start by saying that I think what I've always felt and what I've seen as a judge is no victim should ever walk into a courtroom by themselves.
Mm.
And when I hear the issues that surround what Monique has just talked about, she didn't pipe her own horn here, but I want to point out, she was a very successful businesswoman. She mm-hmm. was, a CEO in different organizations and had an incredible background. And what we talk about a lot was the fact that she was a person of resources, and she still went through some real challenges. But the challenges are even greater for people that don't have resources.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes in this community, people don't have any place to go but right back to their offender because we just don't have the sort of shelters or living spaces enough for the victims. We've got great places here in town, but it's just not enough. People wind up going right back to their original abusers.
Mm-hmm.
I say that all because I would see many different situations before me that certainly were concerning. What I knew was that if someone had an attorney, they're going to be more likely to show up in court mm-hmm. to file their petition. They're going to be more likely to fill out an adequate petition itself. So many different victims that I would see have issues involving reading and writing, have some challenges perhaps because they don't master the English language. And then you throw into the mix the fact that they're in court after perhaps one of the most traumatic events from the previous day.
Mm.
They're not going to be filing the most adequate petitions.
Mm.
And then if you don't have an attorney that's waiting for you at the courthouse for your hearing, the likelihood of you not showing up is very real. Mm-hmm. I've seen it on many an occasion where someone would come to court and they would see that the respondent, the offender, is there, sometimes with an attorney, and they'll just turn around and leave. And you can understand completely why. And of course, the case then would be dismissed. Mm-hmm. But then you take it to the next step. If you don't have an attorney, you're not going to get the relief that you deserve when you walk into that courtroom. And that's a big problem. We have great judges on our bench, but they're not advocates. They can't be in a position to advocate for the petitioner. And without the help that we provide, they're really at a huge disadvantage.
Right. We're talking about the work of the new St. Louis nonprofit, St. Louis Survivors Legal Support, which provides victims of domestic violence with legal representation so they will be more successful in their applications for things like protective orders. With me is its founder and executive director, former Judge Mike Burton, and St. Louis Survivors Legal Support Board President, Pastor Monique Green. The rates at which people are, you know, more or less likely to receive protection or to experience abuse in the first place. Mike, you had talked about those who are not equipped fully to put forth a petition that that presents their case well. You had also mentioned what a judge can and cannot do, and you are now on the other side of the bench as someone who is helping those who need that support to get out of a very bad situation. What has that experience been like?
Well, for starters, Elaine, I come to court on time, all the time. I was notorious every now and then for coming to court when I was running a docket for being a few minutes late. I'm always on time. But it is a different experience. And it's a different experience because being an advocate is so much different than being someone that's listening to a case as a judge. I have a lot of restless nights because you worry about your clients all the time. I've had experiences that really hit home to me how serious the abuse is. One time I went out into the hallway. This is shortly after I became an advocate and was representing individuals. The judge asked me to step outside and talk to the respondent in the hallway to see if we could work out something. Mm-hmm. He didn't like what I had to say. And in a hallway right outside the courtroom, he came up and gave me this huge belly bump. Now, I found it comical to a certain degree.
Right, right.
But then when I went back into the courtroom and the judge asked whether or not we worked it out, I pretty much said, no, we did not. But I really started thinking after that experience, if this guy's doing this to me in a hallway right near some bailiffs, what's going on in the privacy of his own home?
Right.
And it hit me so hard when I would talk to my client at the time, who talked about the many efforts he made to strangle her, that really caused me to take pause as to how serious the situation is.
Right. Now, Monique, part of SLSLS's work is about education. You talked about what attorneys need to know, what they should know, but there's the community education component as well. Who is it that needs education, and what forms, you know, can and should take?
Well, absolutely, attorneys need education, and that's a big part of what SLSLS does. We have training seminars for attorneys to come and learn how to navigate the court process. In my particular case, the order of protection was allowed to expire, or it hit the statute of limitations, so the judge never heard the abuse related to myself and my children. So that is possibly why, in part, the case went in the direction that it went. But the victim needs to be educated. The attorneys need to be educated. Children's services, they need to be educated. The guardian ad litems need to be educated. Families need to be educated. But because without my family support, I don't know that I would have been able to walk through the process.
Right. You know, Mike, in our last couple minutes, I mean, what is it that SLSLS has achieved so far, you know, since you started representing clients in 2023? And what are your hopes for the future?
At this time, I'm proud to say that we've recruited a large number of volunteer attorneys. There was a program that I was involved with in starting the Domestic Violence Court back in 2009 that really counted on the generosity of attorneys to volunteer their time. That's what we're seeing with SLS at this time. I'm seeing incredible members of our bar that are coming forward to volunteer because we need a huge number of volunteers. Right now we have about 150 volunteer attorneys and they're doing amazing work. We've represented over 200 individuals on their cases so far. We've been essentially in business as of the beginning of April of last year. What we want to do is represent more individuals, and we absolutely know that we can, and we're always recruiting. Sometimes attorneys look the other way when they see me coming, but I'm proud to see the incredible things that are happening with the victims that are here in our community.
This episode was produced by Emily Woodbury.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
St. Louis on the Air proudly supports local artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.